is 69 degrees.
And we return. Beautiful weather here in South Florida. I'm here with Bonnie Berman. How are you, Bonnie?
I'm good. I worry about the East Coast, but I love our weather right now.
Well, I do too. Well, today we chat with reporter and author Michael Clare about global natural resource depletion. He's written The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. And he joins us from Northampton, Massachusetts. Welcome to you, Michael Clare.
I'm very pleased to be with you today.
How about an update on Sandy in your area, Northampton, Massachusetts, and preparation that's going on?
Well, you know, we're inland from the coast here, so we're not seeing the storm surge that people are seeing on the coast here. Mainly, we're just seeing high winds, and so far, we still have power, so we're keeping our fingers crossed.
Well, we know all about that here in South Florida. People buying batteries and such, and plywood, and those kind of supplies, I suppose.
Yeah, well, you can't get any of those anymore. We went to the store the other night and last night, and they were all gone.
Well, let's get back to The Race for What's Left, your book. It seems like all of human history has been affected by resource competition. Why is it different now in the in 2012?
What I think is different is a number of things coming together at once. First of all, we have a bigger world population than ever before. Since I've been on the planet, which was in the 1940s, there are only 2.5 billion people then, and now we have 7 billion. So that's the biggest growth in human history, and we have more to come, and all those people need food and shelter and everything else. So that's on one side of the ledger. We also have greater human wealth than ever before, more people in the middle class. And it's not just population. You have to remember, with wealth comes demand for more things, automobiles and air conditioners and flat screen TVs, and those are very resource intensive. So the demand is greater than ever before. And because we're using things so rapidly, a lot of things are being used up. A lot of materials that were once very plentiful are not so plentiful anymore, things like oil and natural gas and coal. Now, it's true that there are more of those things on the planet. I'm not saying they're disappearing, but the easy supplies, the things that come out of the ground very easily, like oil shooting out of the ground in a gusher, those days are now over, and what's left is very hard to get. You have to use fracking water, which is itself a scarce commodity, increasingly to crack open rock to get at oil and natural gas, and so on. So we're in a new resource era where the demand is greater than ever before, and the task of getting it is becoming ever more difficult and expensive and dangerous.
Tell us about the inaccessibility of the remaining oil supplies. You mentioned fracking. What other methods are being used to get at the remaining oil?
Well, we know that about a third of what's left of the world's oil and natural gas is in the Arctic region, and it's exceedingly difficult to get things in the Arctic because of, you know, the bad weather that we're facing today. This is the common, normal state of affairs in the Arctic, except it's much, much colder, but this kind of storm activity is constant there. You have sea ice, so any oil or gas drilling equipment has to be armored to protect against floating ice. You have to drill through the ice in winter. So it's much more difficult to operate up there. Anybody who's unfortunate enough to fall into the water is likely to die very quickly if they're not rescued immediately. So the equipment is more expensive. And the environmental hazard, if you have a spill like you did in the Gulf of Mexico, a spill in the Arctic would be much more catastrophic because the species that live up there have much fewer defenses. They're already living at the edge of survivability, and so a spill would be instantly lethal for most of them, and it's much harder to clean up. There are no rescue vessels up there. So operating in the Arctic is going to be much, much harder than operating anywhere else. And that's where a third of the hydrocarbon resources of the planet are now buried.
Who has claims currently under the Arctic Ocean?
Well, there are five countries that have claims to the Arctic. The United States, by dint of our purchase of Alaska in the 1800s, Canada, tiny little Denmark because it controls Greenland, Russia, and Norway. And all five of those countries are contending for parts of the North Pole area. There's no clear ownership of that region, and so the boundaries are in flux, and there are a lot of disputes over who controls what parts of the Arctic.
I read in your book that Norway even has been showing some military bluster. You never think about the Norwegians being aggressive in the 21st century.
No, but if you follow Norway's wealth, we now think of Norway as a wealthy country because it derives so much of its national income from the production of oil and gas. But this began in the North Sea, relatively low down. Most of that oil and gas is now depleted, and so the Norwegians have to move further and further north into the Barents Sea, which is part of the Arctic Ocean. So their ability to keep deriving wealth from their offshore oil and gas means moving into the Arctic, and they face border disputes with Russia and with Greenland the further north you go. So they've been building up their capacity for military operations in the Arctic region.
What's the most telling part of the book that you'd like people to come away with?
You know, the part that surprised me most and upset me the most is what I discovered about what people call land grabs. These are efforts by people to buy agricultural land, farmland, in other parts of the world so that they could be assured of having enough food in the future when food becomes a scarce commodity, even though the people in the farmlands may starve. So you find people like countries like China and South Korea and the Persian Gulf countries buying big pieces of land in Ethiopia and Somalia where people are starving in order to produce food to ship it back to their own country. This really upsets me that you would buy other countries' cropland to feed your population and not worry about the plight of people and their own lands.
Who's allowing that land to be purchased in these countries where the people are already starving?
You know, wealthy government elites in those countries, and, you know, I suspect bribery is involved. Often the lands are said to be virgin land, untouched land, virgin in quotation marks. But in fact, they're occupied by pastoralists, indigenous people who have cattle and who roam the area, like the Plains Indians in our own country, who are despised by the elites who live in the city. So they don't care about the plight of those people, and they're willing to sell off the land to foreign governments and make some money on the side.
That's just incredible. You mentioned China. Can we talk about the situation in China and how it's affecting the world on a global level?
Well, you know, China is approaching being the world's biggest economy and certainly the biggest user of energy at this point, the biggest user of most raw materials, iron, copper, coal, cement, aluminum, just about everything else. And it has the world's biggest population. And China does supply itself with a lot of things from its own territory, but it's impossible for China to feed its population and to build all those things that we buy in our stores at Walmart and elsewhere, made in China, to produce all those things with its own raw materials. So China's becoming increasingly dependent on imports of things from the rest of the world. especially Africa now. And so China is forced to go to Africa, to Latin America, to Central Asia, and become the major procurer of raw materials and get involved in those countries in a way that resembles the imperial powers of Europe in the old days.
So oil prices can only go higher.
Oil prices can only go higher because the oil industry is not capable of increasing the supply fast enough to meet our needs for oil and Europe and Japan's needs, and a vast increase in demand coming from China. When you consider right now, there are only probably about 70 million cars in private hands in China, but there are projections that in another quarter of a century, there may be 700 million cars in China on their highways. And think of every one of them, if they're like cars of today, and they all driving up to the gas station every day, filling it up with oil, they're going to be competing with us for every last drop of oil, and that's going to push oil through the roof.
We're speaking with reporter and author Michael Clare. We're talking about his book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. Michael, stay with us. We're going to take a short break and be back with more.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. We're funded by listeners like you and by South Florida Dental Implant Group. Dental implants can alleviate the discomfort of dentures, loss of taste, and difficulty chewing. The South Florida Dental Implant Group dedicated to giving you the freedom to chew. Details at 1-800-541-3010.
After a spate of so-called green-on-blue attacks, U.S. troops restricted joint operations with Afghan forces. Retired Army officer Doug Ollivant called this
the latest in a series of setbacks and/or bad news.
Retired Army officer John Nagel says America needs to be reminded of what it's really like to lose a war. I'm Neil Conan, defining success in Afghanistan. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This afternoon at 2.
Like Topical Currents' Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Good to have you with us. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with reporter and author Michael Clare about global natural resource depletion. His latest book is The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you're very welcome to do so. Our number is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN, or you can email us at radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. Michael Clare, do you believe that the Persian Gulf War and the war in Iraq had oil at the heart of their invasions?
Oh, absolutely. Now, there are two wars in the Persian Gulf. One was the 1991 war, Operation Desert Storm, and then there was the 2003 invasion of Iraq. And the first war was explicitly a war about oil. President Bush said that we have to protect Saudi Arabia against the Iraqis when they invaded Kuwait because of oil, and later, we have to eject the Iraqis from Kuwait because Kuwait was an important supplier of oil. So there was no question about that. The doubt arose in the second war in 2003 when U.S. forces invaded Iraq, and the second President Bush said this was about weapons of mass destruction and democracy in the Middle East. But his vice president, Dick Cheney, said it was about geopolitics, about maintaining America's dominance in the region, about our friends, and about oil. So I don't think there's any question that both wars were based to a considerable considerable extent about oil, but not necessarily about Iraq's oil, about dominance of the region, ensuring that the U.S. and its allies would have access to the oil supplies of the Persian Gulf region, and that oil tankers would have free ability to go from the Persian Gulf through the Strait of Hormuz to the rest of the world. This has been an American objective since President Roosevelt was in office. And this could be the cause of a war again in 2012 if the Iranians attempt, as they have threatened to do, to close the Strait of Hormuz and block the flow of oil. That would be a cause of war, and it could happen very soon.
Again, our telephone number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Michael Clare, tell me, it seems like the Asian countries are, their governments are solidly behind securing these resources, but how about the future of, say, U.S. private enterprise in resource acquisition?
The oil companies and the natural gas companies, they are absolutely determined to perpetuate a business model and an economic model based on fossil fuels. You don't see much evidence that ExxonMobil or Chevron or any of the other oil and gas companies intend to move anytime soon to renewable sources of energy. So they're determined to perpetuate the oil way of life. And we see that in the advertising for the presidential elections. Even though they're not taking sides, they're spending millions of dollars on advertising that says, let's drill our way into the future, more oil, more natural gas, more coal. So yes, they are very much seeking to perpetuate an oil and gas and coal-based economy. But that's going to mean increasing the level of environmental risk, because most of the oil and gas that could be obtained easily has now been depleted. So we're going to have to go further offshore or to use fracking or other means that will raise the level of environmental risk.
We've really only been touching on oil
as
the resource. But how about, tell us more about the rare earth elements that we use for our digital TVs and cell phones and solar panels.
Mm. Yeah, these are minerals that are vital for modern electronics, portable electronics, and also things like hybrid cars and solar panels and wind turbines. Now, right now, most of the rare earths are produced in China, but this is not because China has the world's largest supply of them. It's because producing rare earths is extremely hazardous to the environment. It's because they exist in very low concentrations, usually in composite rocks with other things, typically with radioactive materials, low-level radioactive materials, and you have to use acids and arsenic to leach out the rare earths from everything else. So what you're left is small quantities of very valuable rare earths and large amounts of highly toxic radioactive wastes.
So,
the United States once produced these, but we shut them down because of the environmental risk, and the Chinese therefore took up production.
So green technology such as solar panels actually has an environmental impact.
It does. Not so much solar panels, but those hybrid cars are the largest users of rare earths. And even though I champion the use of hybrid cars because they reduce the use of petroleum, there is a problem because of their use of rare earths, and it's very important that we find out ways to produce rare earths in an environmentally non-hazardous way.
Is there any thing underway? Is there any movement underway to do that?
Well, yes. In California, they're planning to restart the rare earth mine at Mountain Pass, California, under much stricter environmental oversight, and the company that's doing that, claims that they could do it in a safe manner, but it's going to be very, very expensive, so we'll have to see if they're succeeding at that.
You talked about the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians for water.
Yes.
Tell us about that and how it exacerbates an already very bad situation.
Well, I believe that most conflicts in the world today have a resource dimension to them. Now, they may very well have other dimensions, like, as you say, the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. Obviously, there are ethnic and religious dimensions, but water is scarce in that part of the world, and it's likely to become more so in the future. So every drop of water is precious, and in the case of the West Bank area, the West Bank of the Jordan River, which is occupied by Israel, they allow the Israeli settlers to have up to 10 times more water per capita than the Palestinians. And when water is scarce, that is seen as terrible discrimination, terrible deprivation, and it increases the anger of the Palestinians. It fuels their anger.
What kind of shortages are we talking about when you say the shortage of water? I mean, how scarce is it there?
Well, that's a part of the world where rainfall is very scarce, and there are only a few sources of water. The Jordan River itself, which, you know, if you see paintings of that and biblical images, you think of a big, wide river like the Mississippi. But it's a very small river and not nearly enough for the growing population there. So on a per capita basis, there's only a few gallons a day of water for the people living in the West Bank.
The same
problem is growing in adjacent areas. The Nile River, the world's one of the most storied rivers in human history, and the Tigris-Euphrates, where civilization began, these rivers are at grave risk because of global warming, that the supply of water may actually decrease, but population is increasing in both of those areas, so the per capita supply is dropping to very dangerous levels.
Let's take a telephone call. We've got Don. Don in Miami. Hi there.
Hi, Joe. It seems that American interests in pursuing the remaining fossil fuels correlates with short-term corporate interests in quarterly reports and profit, not national interests for the coming centuries. Don't such pursuits actually guarantee 100% dependence on foreign oil in the future? Don't we need to conserve our remaining oil for non-fuel use, such as manufacturing plastics and fertilizers? Don't we need a race to the moon type of policy to develop alternative energy sources?
Well, I agree with the caller, Don, that we need to have a very substantial program of research on oil alternatives, because the fact is it will run out between now and 2050, except supplies that are very costly to produce. There'll still be oil, but it'll be very costly to produce, and there'll be a lot of competition. And I agree, we have to preserve oil for the needs that are most important, for emergency vehicles, for ambulances, for fire trucks, and a whole lot of other uses. We have to ration what's left for the most important purposes. So I agree with a lot of what he says. And it's true that we're going to continue to depend on foreign sources of oil for a long time, because even if we were to increase our offshore drilling in the Gulf of Mexico and in offshore Atlantic, it's still not going to be enough to satisfy our needs. So the caller is right that we must increase our research on oil alternatives.
We're speaking with Michael Clare. He's an author and reporter, and we're talking about his latest book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. Michael, stay with us. We need to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
This is 91.3 WLRN and HD1, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and the Palm Beaches. That's your NPR news station for South Florida, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys. We'll be back to topical currents in just a moment. Join us on WLRN TV 17 for Chihuly Outside, a documentary about famed artist Dale Chihuly. It offers a magical glimpse into the conception and installation of Chihuly's artistic outside world. That's Wednesday, November 7th at 8 p.m. only on WLRN TV Channel 17.
Hello, it's Bonnie Berman. Join us for Tuesday's Topical Currents and a visit with employment expert and attorney Donna Ballman. She'll join us in studio and discuss her book, Stand Up for Yourself Without Getting Fired. Workplace issues can grow into crises in the blink of an eye. Ballman has tips to diffuse them before they escalate. And of course, we'll take your calls. That's Topical Currents Tuesday at 1 o'clock.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And we're joined by Michael Clare. We're talking about his book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. Michael, how about a website where people can learn more about you and your books?
Oh, well, thank you. Yes, it's michaelclare.com, and you spell my last name K-L-A-R-E. I also write regularly for the online newspaper, news magazine, tomdispatch.com.
What is that called?
TomDispatch.com.
So how do we find new ways to power our world? It seems like an overwhelming proposition.
Well, you know, many people are working on that. And in addition to being a writer, as you say, I'm a college professor at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. And I travel to many colleges and universities. And I suspect some of your listeners also are students or travel to universities and are aware that a lot of our young scientists are themselves engaged in research on future alternatives. And the Department of Energy under President Obama has been putting money into this. I know there's a debate about whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, and I leave it to your listeners to decide for themselves whether this is a good idea or a bad idea. But in fact, a lot of research is now underway to look at the alternatives, better solar power, better wind power, new forms of biofuels that are better than the current generation based on corn. Corn is a bad idea because it's a food crop. Geothermal power, getting energy from the heat of the interior of the earth, and wave power looks very promising for the future. If we could harness the power of waves and tides, I was in Maine last week, and there's some very interesting experiments underway there and off the coast of Oregon and Washington State. So there's a lot of very promising research underway. The task will be to commercialize that, as they say, to bring it from, you know, laboratory-scale projects to large-scale projects that actually generate electricity for homes and businesses. And that's where the problem that we discussed earlier about the intent of the giant energy companies like ExxonMobil and Chevron, they're interested in producing oil and gas. That's their business model. We understand that. But they're not going to invest in commercializing other kinds of energy that'll put them out of business someday. So it's finding the investors who will put the money into making these alternatives eventually satisfy our needs when we need them.
You'd think that they're so big that there would be no way that they'd ever be out of business, you know, as you say. Why wouldn't they invest in some of these other ways? They see the global situation.
Well, I think they want to perpetuate our dependence on oil and natural gas and coal for as long as they possibly can. They know this can't last forever, but they think that they can keep this going for, you know, another few decades at least. Why not? That's the way our economic system works. Eventually, other forms of energy are going to come along that will prove to be superior, but, you know, they're going to hold them at bay as long as they possibly can.
How do you feel about nuclear?
You're sounding like George W.
Yeah,
now.
I know. I heard it too much. Nuclear energy.
Well, the current my view is that the current nuclear technology is not a very promising solution. There are too many dangers associated with it, particularly the storage of the toxic radioactive wastes hasn't been solved. Now, my friends in the physics department say that, you know, there's some promising research underway on new forms, new kinds of reactors that eliminate the problem of waste and eliminate the problem of proliferation. And if those problems could be overcome, then nuclear could be very promising.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, fusion power in another couple of generations may prove practical. But those are not, none of these future nuclear reactor styles are likely to be available anytime soon. Thorium reactors is another approach that people are telling me about and could conceivably be the solution. Maybe we have to put more money into these nuclear options to speed up the process. But that's my problem. We're not investing enough money in the alternatives to the current energy paradigm to ensure that when we need them, which is going to be much sooner than people think, that we have a whole menu of alternative choices ready to put in place. We're just not moving swiftly enough to have that menu available.
Let's take a telephone call. This is listener Gonzalo in Davie. Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing? I just wanted to call and clarify one of the questions about saving oil for future needs. And your guest says, yes, you know, we need to save it for possibly, you know, running our, you know, ambulances and fire trucks. And that really seems like a doomsday scenario that is not real. Oil in the liquid form, yes, we do have a very limited amount of supply, but it can be derived from coal at a higher cost, and we have enough, you know, to last actually hundreds of years at that level. So I was also wondering if your guest had, you know, read this book by Richard Mueller about, you know, physics for future presidents, and in which, you know, he explains all of the different options about energy, you know, oil and nuclear, electricity and whatnot. But I think that it is important that people don't think that oil, it's only limited for the next 20, 30 years, because that is only the liquid form. And again, it can be derived at a higher cost in different ways.
Michael Clear, how about a comment?
Well, your caller is absolutely right that diesel in particular can be obtained from coal. It is an expensive process, and it's environmentally risky process. A lot of carbon is released using current technology to do this. So it can be done. Coal, we think that coal, there's a lot of coal left, but most of the good coal has now been consumed, the hard-burning easily accessible coal has now been depleted. So what's left of coal is less desirable grades, and a lot of it is going to be accessible only through processes like mountaintop removal, which has tremendous environmental dangers associated with it.
What
so
are
there will be trade-offs in all of this. All of these energy choices involve trade-offs, which the public can decide whether or not it wants to proceed with them. But we have to bear in mind these environmental trade-offs.
What are the dangers environmentally of the mountaintop removal?
Yeah, well, this is likely to be intensified, I believe, if Mr. Romney is elected, because his energy platform calls for greater reliance on coal, and that probably would mean greater support for mountaintop removal. That's where you blast off the top of mountains, especially in Appalachia, to get at the coal seams below, and then you strip mine them. But you produce a tremendous amount of debris, which is mixed with toxic chemicals, and you have to dump them into the valleys and streams below. So those streams and the land around them become contaminated with toxic chemicals. And so that's where the environmental risk comes from.
How about a time frame for when this crisis could become even more critical?
We're in a crisis now. If you go to the gas pump and see the prices, it may go down, it's going to go up, it'll go down. But this is the new normal situation, I believe, where we're not going to see cheap prices for energy, for liquid energy, and anytime soon. Natural gas is still quite low because of the current boom in fracking, and that will continue for a while in the United States. But worldwide, the supply of energy is simply not growing sufficiently to meet rising demand. So we're talking about a slow growing crisis that will increase over time. And I think the same is true for water, for food, and for many minerals.
You say we need efficiency, conservation, and more renewable energy sources, but how do we go about this? And you can talk about all three of them.
Yes. Well, eventually our whole industrial paradigm that we've all relied on since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in this country and around the world is not going to be viable at a certain point. And that's an energy system based on consuming ever more resources ad infinitum into the future. It won't be possible to do that beyond a certain point. So in the future, economic growth will depend on using less resources, using materials, fewer and fewer materials to get the maximum advantage. So transportation systems that are super efficient, cars that could go 100 miles on a gallon of gas, for example, that's the sort of thing I'm talking about, or ultra-efficient public transit systems and airplanes and houses that require very little energy to heat. You're getting that in Germany now, where they have houses that are so efficient with their insulation that they need practically no heating energy. This is where the industrial revolution of the future will lie, and I tell my students that this is where there will be economic opportunities in the future. New cities, new transportation systems, new everything based on efficiency, minimum use of resources, recycling resources, and creating new resources from things that are super abundant.
You know, we live in a city here with just an abysmal public transportation system here in South Florida. So what measures can one take in such an environment as this?
Well, you could promote bicycle use, as they're doing in many parts of the world. If your listeners, as I'm sure some of them do, travel to Paris or Amsterdam or London or Barcelona, Madrid, they'll find at every subway stop, every public square, ranks of bicycles for rent, and bike lanes everywhere. That's becoming an increasingly popular form of mass transportation.
Well, they're trying to do that here, but the bike lanes have to share the roads with the cars.
And yeah, well, you have to pressure then for, you know, as more people drive bikes, they're going to be a larger political constituency, and they'll demand more space on the roads. Mayor Bloomberg of New York City, who I heard speak on this last spring, you know, you wouldn't think New York City would be friendly, but indeed, the bike lanes are getting bigger and taking over more and more parts of the city. It can be done.
Let's take a telephone call. This is Katie in Miami. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to comment on something your guest said. He said that the oil and gas companies are not putting any money towards researching alternative fuels. And I've been told multiple times that that's not the case. I have two family members that work for Shell and two family members that work for Chevron, and both of those companies are putting huge amounts of money towards different kinds of alternative energy research, including biofuels like algae. So I just wanted to know, I just wanted to make sure that he knew that they're definitely researching different types of fuel, and I understand that they're benefiting from oil usage now, but they're looking forward.
Okay, Katie, I appreciate your call, and I should have said something to this effect. I should have clarified my remarks. They're not, the energy companies are investigating algae and other forms of liquid fuel that could be blended with oil and natural gas, or blended with oil, which would allow them to perpetuate the reliance on petroleum as a form of transportation energy. So far as I know, they're not researching alternative forms of energy altogether that would make petroleum obsolete. But you're quite right, they are looking at biofuels that could be blended with oil and natural gas or whatever to perpetuate existing, you know, that their gas stations and refineries and so on that don't pose a fundamental threat to their way of doing business. That's my understanding. But you are right, they are doing research on these advanced biofuels.
Okay, Katie, thanks for your call.
Thanks.
And you have an emailer?
Yes, from Rolando in Fort Lauderdale. Can you please ask your guest about deforestation and the current state of our forests globally?
Oh, deforestation is a big worry on multiple fronts. I worry in particular about the Amazon, where deforestation is picking up again after it had been slowed down for a while. I worry about it in Central Africa, and I worry about it in the islands of Indonesia and the Pacific, where it's accelerating. Deforestation is bad in many respects. It's bad because we're losing, in many cases, old-growth forests that are of unique species that aren't being replaced. And, you know, sometimes the forest product companies say, well, we're replacing trees, but often not the same species, not the old trees that are very precious. But deforestation is bad also because when you clear out a forest, you also clear out the habitat in which all kinds of unique species disappear with them, and we lose them forever, and it's bad. Most of all, I worry now because it contributes to the heating of the planet, and that's we're seeing in so many ways how dangerous that can be.
Tell me, Michael Clare, talking about global natural resource depletion, what about potential military confrontations associated with the scramble? Who would be more likely to be a participant?
I worry about that at two levels. I worry about that at the level of you know, people fighting over a water source, like we've seen in the fighting in Darfur in Africa, where you have tribes, neighboring tribes, when water becomes scarce and you have tribes that used to live in peace, but when their water supply disappears and there's just one water hole left for everyone, the risk of fighting over diminishing supplies of water. That's one kind of conflict I worry about, and I think the fighting in Darfur is somewhat triggered by that kind of resource scarcity. And then I worry about nations going to war. And right now, the most dangerous area in that regard is the East China Sea and the South China Sea. We've heard a lot lately about naval confrontations between China and Japan in the East China Sea, and between China and the Philippines and Vietnam in the South China Sea. And all we hear about is these islands, the Senkaku Islands, the Spratly Islands that are uninhabited. Why are they going to war over those uninhabited islands? Well, it's not the islands, but whoever controls those islands controls the water around them, and under the water around them are large oil and natural gas reserves that have yet been undeveloped because nobody has yet been able to pin down who they belong to. But once that's determined, they're very valuable oil and natural gas reserves there.
And another caller. This is Farid in Miami.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
This is Farid Tawari calling. I was listening to your guest, very wonderful, nice points. But with some of them, I do not agree. For instance, I do not see that there will be a war in Middle East, because if a single bullet is fired in Persian Gulf, the oil prices will jump so high that we will be paying about $8, $9, $10 per gallon on gasoline, and that would be the end of the world economy. I think there is a possibility, and there is a great possibility, that we could get free energy if we knew how to do it. And unfortunately, we have politicians that they do not understand technology. And then another thing regarding the oil companies, that they do not care about alternative energy. I would suggest that they should look into GM and Chrysler and so on. They will be forced to develop and manufacture alternative energy technologies, because they know also very well that the oil is going to deplete. And I don't think oil should be, and your guest was very right, we should not use it as a source of energy. It is a source of, we should use it as a source of food, raw material, and medicine. And this is, these are the things, but we need politicians that they understand technology. And this is the problem we are having. And we have no plan for technology.
Michael Clare, would you like to comment?
We will be making next 20 years, next 10 years, next 2 years. And the market will not take
care of it. Let me respond.
Otherwise, they were doing it. And we have to develop alternative energy resources such as solar energy. And the fact is, we have to go decentralized solar and wind energy, because this
Farid, we're very close to the end of the program. Please let the guests respond.
And, that's kind of what I've been saying. And Farid has said that there won't be a war in the Persian Gulf. First, that was his first comment. And I sincerely hope he's correct. And probably the chances are that it will not occur. But President Obama has said that if Iran does move ahead to develop nuclear weapons and negotiations fail, that he's prepared to use military force. And I believe him. And Mitt Romney, his contender, says the same thing. And I think they will do so, even if the price of oil rises. I worry about this very deeply. The Iranians have said that they will close the Strait of Hormuz even in the absence of a war, as a response to tightening economic sanctions. So I don't think we can rule this out. And the caller spoke about free energy, and my physicist friend says that this runs contrary to the rules of nature.
Well, we certainly want to thank you. It's been a very informative hour. We've been speaking with Michael Clare about global natural resource depletion And his book is called The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
My pleasure.
And that wraps up today's edition. My apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical supervision by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary gives production assistance. Find author and book links such as today's on the Topical Currents Facebook page. We also have free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our website, WLRN.org. And tomorrow's program is with Fort Lauderdale employment law attorney Donna Ballman. She'll discuss her book, Stand Up for Yourself Without Getting Fired. She says what you think you know about employment rights is probably dead wrong. And to the calendar, on this day in 1874, 138 years ago, the birth of modernist composer Charles Ives in Danbury, Connecticut. Probably America's first musician to have international acclaim. His father was a Civil War bandleader. And on this day in 1947, 65 years ago, the House Un-American Activities Committee opens public hearings on alleged communist infiltration of Hollywood. Among those denounced were Katharine Hepburn, Charlie Chaplin, and even Edward G. Robinson. One more while we reflect on the Camelot era. On this day in 1968, 42 years ago, 5 years after President Kennedy's assassination, Jacqueline Kennedy marries Aristotle Onassis on the Isle of Scorpios. And we leave with a thought from Jackie O, recalling the death of JFK, quote, "He didn't even have the satisfaction of being killed for civil rights. It had to be some silly little communist." This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is 91.3.